CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the CoinWorld Podcast. I'm Jeff Stark.
And I'm Larry Jewett, and boy, am I tired. And I know you should be tired, too, because it was a busy, busy week last week, and but man, oh man, I would not trade it for anything. It was great to see a lot of folks again. Great to be back out there and meeting up with it. Seems like it's been forever ago since the last time we were out back at Central States, or fun, actually. So it hasn't actually been all that long, but just the idea that we were able to take on Pittsburgh. So happy that Pittsburgh was finally able to hold the World's Fair money for the American Numismatic Association. And good luck to all those new governors who were sworn in and now part of the ANA's objective for the next couple of years.
Hey, yeah, City of Bridges was a great host and we had lots of fun, and we can talk about some of that. And it's going to take several episodes really to talk about that and to recover from the events. Lots of walking on the bourse. What a fun time. But we're going to have a fun time in this episode because you're going to hear a great interview. Well, the subject is great. I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but Taylor Leverage is the author of a fantastic book about chop mark coins. You're going to want to stick around for that. It's a fantastic book. Can't say enough good things about it. You'll hear all about it though in just a bit, and of course we're going to delve into the usual buffet of numismatic history and all that. It's time to take a breath and pause and reflect. The ANA was great. We're ready to hit it hard the rest of the year. It's sort of a nice milestone. Not millstone, milestone in the year. You make it to that, and then I always am looking forward. Then the next big thing is Berlin, and you never know. You know, maybe there's something else in there too. We're always coming up with some special fun stuff. So that is where we stand. It's we're already almost through 9 months of the year. School is coming back in session, and we are back in session for another episode.
Well, I'm wondering why you're skipping over October here, because I know I'm going to be in Nashville for the International Money Expo that's going to be happening. We talked about a couple of episodes ago, and I may send you to Canada too. Who knows? But you have to promise to come back. But, I want to go quickly to the interview here today. You know, you talk about the book, which is no doubt a fantastic book. But to me, the subject of the book is just something that is really, you know, just makes it. I hold it in awe to know about what was going on and thinking about what the times were like and how the idea came about of what the, some people look upon a chop mark coin as a damaged coin. So it's just not. It's got some historical significance to it. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, hold your fire. We'll get into that in just a bit. I think first, though, we should explore what was happening in numismatic history in the day. And I went back to 1987 because that was the year that Frank Rose published his book about chop mark coins. That was really the first book and about the subject, and it was based on his collection. So what was happening in, we'll get to that. That's the coin world issue. Sorry, we'll get that in a minute. But what was happening in numismatic history? Well, what are we going to? It's actually 1942 when the Philadelphia Mint began coining the wartime silver Jefferson 5-cent coins. We know about this series of wartime coins because of their silver, partially silver composition. and the fact that they have the giant mint mark on the reverse above Monticello. They are sold and bought today, often by the bag. Certainly dealers trade bags among themselves and sell those bags to the nickel hoarder, the bullion stacker. I'll never forget when I was in college getting striking it rich, if you will, and I think, man, if I'd only held on to them. At my local bank, I want to say I got 16 rolls of war nickels at face value. Thank you, Nevin, the bank teller. And I went ahead and listed those on eBay because I was a poor college kid. And I sold them for the whopping sum of around $9 to $10 a roll. And today it would be, you know, $40 to $50 a roll. So, hindsight 2020 and all that. It's a very important moment in American numismatic history. I also like the fact that same day, August 18th in 1862, was when Confederate President Jefferson Davis decried the fact that Northerners were supplying federal troops with counterfeit Confederate States of America paper money. And, you know, we've talked about that on the program before. It's a curious aspect of wartime history, the fact that economic warfare is just one more leg in the stool that governments can use. I mean, we had the interview with Danny Spungen a while back about the Bank of England notes that were being forged by the Germans during World War II. Economic warfare in that regard, using counterfeits, is almost like a just a next level psyops exercise, because, you know, it doesn't require the slings of bullets and arrows, if you will, but the bashing of printing presses or actual presses, if you're talking about coins being, coinage presses, if you're talking about coins being struck. So it's a neat aspect, and that's what jumped out to me for August 18th in 1942 and 1862.
Well, the thing about the Confederate, I mean, and there was a lot of, not during conflict time, but obviously a lot of real looking currency made up for tourist attractions. And so then it makes it even more difficult to find the things that are legit on the market. So I'm thankful for the experts like Pierre over in San Antonio, who help get things straight, make sure we all, you know, when we go to acquire some of these specimens from the year, that we actually get really what was issued by the Confederate States of America, not issued by as a prank, more or less, or issued as a souvenir for those who were traveling down the interstates back in the 60s to go to the land of opportunity that was Florida, and stopping at the souvenir shops. And what better souvenir than when you're south of the Mason-Dixon line than some Confederate notes? So, but the legitimate ones are the ones that, you know, you really love to have in your possession. So
is that a story born of your childhood?
More or less, I can think back to some of the trips that we made from the north down to, we were only going to Myrtle Beach. Myrtle Beach was a place that we went to a lot. And you pass by a lot of those roadside stands and picking up the produce of the region that you don't necessarily get as readily someplaces else. And there's always the, you know, you get further down to Florida, you can buy the alligator heads and things like that. But I mean, just, yeah, that, I don't know if those are real or not, but it just doesn't matter. But, you know, just having having something that's neat and authentic is the best. And then to hear that, you know, the nefarious forces were, you know, creating phony money right off the bat and just under the guise of conflict. It's just, and we know it's happened in the world as well. I think we go back to Frank Holt and talking about his book as well in the Middle East, how, you know, or in those regions, that there was money that was not necessarily legit. So.
Absolutely. And Confederates are a tricky subject. You got to be informed. Of course, that's That's not really a good segue, but I think it's time to delve into the This Week in Coin World History. And as I was saying earlier, went with 1987 issue, in this case, August 19. And that was because of the Frank Rose connection, and that aligns with our interview with Taylor Leverage about Chopmark coins. And it was just a luck of a draw that I said, well, how about 1987? Because of that was when this book, the first book, came out. And then I go look at the lead story of the Coin World, and what is the headline? But Battelle report indicates objective grading possible. Technology exists to eliminate subjectivity. And here we are, gosh, 35, 36 years later. This story was about how scientists at Battelle Memorial Institute of Columbus, Ohio, believe that current technology, computer technology, could be harnessed to objectively grade coins. Computerized grading, assisted grading through electronic equipment to objectively grade collectible and investment quality coins, it has long been a dream, and there were several initiatives to bring this to life, and unfortunately that has not panned out. I kind of think it's, you know, almost a debate akin to in baseball, where, you know, there's people who don't like the fact that there's instant replay review type stuff that goes on. You can overturn plays, and you can't, of course, question balls or strikes, and that's still a bone of contention for many. But even the umpires are graded with modern technology. And here we have a story that goes into how, thanks to electronic coin grading system, coin grading would be uniform. That is, if the same coin has not been physically altered, it would receive the same grade every single time, no matter how many times you submitted it for grading. Completely objective. You could have this technology at an authorized coin dealer business. You could have, this would standardize coin grading, so there's no longer subjectivity. Experts could be used to establish the reference coin data. And once that reference was established, human judgments would be eliminated. It just goes on, and it's very fascinating to read this with the understanding that here we are 36 years later, and it has not happened. Has not come. I mean, you know, like I say, there's been efforts, but there is no computerized grading now. I can think of a sense where, and I've seen this at one of my local shops in St. Louis. The Royal Canadian Mint several years ago, maybe about a decade ago, came out with a little, it's barely bigger than a softball. It's this little electronic machine gizmo that you can put silver maple leafs and gold maple leafs in. And if they are from that year or the year later or newer, if they're dated that and newer, and they're put in this machine, the machine can verify that these are legitimate coins and not counterfeits, which, you know, counterfeits are an issue we've talked about again and again and again. And so the fact that there hasn't been this implemented for grading, but there are other applications of the technology, maybe it bodes well. You know, but there's a lot of talk these days about AI and its impact, and I may even have something on that in the print page of the Coin World if some folks cooperate. But why don't we have computerized grading 36 years later, when that is such a key topic, I guess, key application. So anyway, that was, I thought, of most importance and interest today, because grading is such a talked about and important aspect of the hobby.
Yeah, and this is one of those situations, though, that if you do it, you want to make sure you do it right. because if you do it wrong, then you really set yourself back quite a way. So I'm sure there's a lot of concern about doing it right. My turn. All right.
Oh, really? I don't disagree there. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. No worries.
It's still, you know, one would think, and maybe there's something going on out there that we don't know about. I'm not suggesting that's the case. But, you know, you think that maybe the time is ripe for that. But in any event, that was what I saw. Did you happen to see anything in the letters that spoke to you?
Oh, yeah, there were quite a few of them, actually. There was one about seeking a national club for young collectors. There were a couple of them related to designs. But the one that got my attention is the question, collect or invest? Now, I know many go through this. What are you going to do? How are you going to pursue this hobby? Is it going to be a hobby? Is it going to be a business? How's it going to be done? So the letter starts out, to collect or to invest? That is the question. As a recently returned collector, I'm much chagrined. I had looked forward to this time in my life when I would have fulfilled my familiar responsibilities and would be financially able to collect rarities. Higher costs, better grades of coins now would be affordable to me. I would now have time for my hobby. But the thrill and challenge of numismatics, which is defined in the dictionary as the study or collections of coins, tokens, and paper money, and sometimes related objects such as metals, is and should be always in the chase, the pursuit of a special coin to meet a void in a series or type, and even more exciting in the finding of a rare coin in an examined hoard, cash, or in pocket change. Upon my return to collecting full-time, I have subscribed to all the trade journals, papers, and magazines, as well as purchased updated books and catalogs on the hobby. After reading these publications, I have come to believe that the fun of collecting per se has been relegated to a secondary position. In fact, collectors are perceived as a necessary evil by most dealers today as persons to dump on their valueless investment specimens / coins. It's investors who are front and center and who are considered most important persons. The sad part of this new reality is that even the old line dealers seem to be succumbing to the new force in the marketplace of numismatics. I'm writing to suggest to those who truly are interested in preserving the hobby of numismatics that dealers direct their attention and services to the needs of the collector, all types, and a better understanding of they, the collector's, various abilities to participate at all ages and income levels. I remember in my early years of collecting, and I suspect if you were to ask a true collector, a true numismatist, the real joy and sense of accomplishment within this hobby is the finding of an about uncirculated or circulated rare coin or filler. Maybe the real coin values truly lie in the circulated rare coins, particularly of those circulated coins from countries and colonies no longer in existence. I would be interested if any of our readers agree with me. If enough do, maybe together we can return to numismatics and leave investing to the financial industry. That is Carmen Pignatello from Calumet City, Illinois. And a good letter right there. And certainly, even in 1987, it rings true.
Absolutely. There is always, I think, again, one of those common threads, the sort of tension between collectors and dealers when it's unnecessary. And, you know, the fact that the dealers need the collectors and the collectors need the dealers. And I don't want to, you know, get all, you know, Rodney King on you and say, why can't we all just get along? But, you know, it takes two to tango. And there's definitely, I mean, I didn't participate in the hobby at a level that anywhere near what I would get to participate when I went to Coin World at for several years, because I went to a local show in St. Louis, and it was very, teenager, and it was not welcoming. So I appreciate those folks who make it welcoming, especially for the young ones. And we're seeing a lot of young folks who are, I won't say moving mountains, but man, they are shaking things up, doing a lot of things, very active, and turning this into this passion and this knowledge and interest into a career and an endeavor that, you know, they're probably, I think, folks that are just getting into it in the last few years that are going to be 40, 50 years into this, you know, make it a lifelong pursuit. And whether you're a collector or a dealer, good for you if that's the way you're going. So anyway, I want to say before I get too far off track, we spend too much time yammering, it's time to put you to the test. And when I put you to the test last episode, I did not think about with whom I was speaking, because this is a question that I asked last week that any good Ohio native should know. At least they should have an idea of to whom I was referring. You might not know the coin featuring this person, or coins, if you will, but I wanted to know because we spoke with Daniel Malone of Portsmouth Coin Shop, and Portsmouth, Ohio is known for their flood wall mural. I wanted to know who that appears on the wall appears on World Coins. And bonus was, what coin or coins are these? And this is, any student of American Revolutionary history has a good shot at this. Certainly any Ohio native who went through the curricula that tells the state's history has a good chance at knowing this, at least part of this. What do you think the answer is?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I saw Roy Rogers, I think, in one of the pictures, and I thought, well, maybe that's the guy, but nah, that's not it. It's not Roy Rogers. There's so many things that could have been from Southern Ohio. There's a lot of connection to history down there, and that wall is huge. It's fantastic. I mean, baseball scenes on it, and all kinds of great, I mean, statues, just all kinds of great things. But I'm not sure, you know, there's a Jackie Robinson section, and I'm not sure if that's what we're after here, but that's pretty much where I'm at.
No, that's a good idea. And of course, Jackie appears on U.S. coins, and I'm sure probably appears on some coin of Liberia or some such place. I don't know of anything offhand. But the person that I was thinking of is the Native American who goes, is known by the English name Tecumseh.
Mm, yes.
And Tecumseh, for those who aren't aware, was a Shawnee chief and warrior who resisted the U.S. expansion into Native lands. And Tecumseh was involved in the War of 1812 effort, and on the Canadian side, on the British side, really, but in, you know, modern times, it's land that's in Canada now. And so for the bicentennial in 2012, Canada issued a circulating commemorative quarter. There's two versions of it. One has is plain, and one has a colorful red maple leaf with the bicentennial logo in there. There was also a collector version, collector coin with a with the same design, but basically, but with a silver composition and $4 denomination. So technically, there are three different coins of Canada that show Tecumseh, who appears on the Portsmouth flood wall in Portsmouth, Ohio. So this speaks to the reality that I tell lots of folks all the time, you know, name a topic and I can bring it back to coins. It's probably the most boring party game ever, but you know,
6 degrees of separation. I gotcha.
Yeah. So
that may be a new feature. We'll have to do that. We may have to try to connect certain things and then go with, I mean, there is a, they do that with certain rock stars and things and certain actors. So maybe we'll have to look into that sometime. Maybe that could become a new feature there where we get connected as anyway. But anyway, I mean, Portsmouth, a great place to visit. Unfortunately, a lot of times for me, it was just passing through, so I didn't get a chance to enjoy some of the aspects of the Southern Ohio. I mean, it's just, I just found out something about a, I think it was a Dairy Queen in Athens, which is nearby. I believe that was the place where the blizzard actually got its start. So they didn't pay for that ad. So that's all we're going to talk about on that one. So anyway, I kind of swung on this one and didn't quite get it. I'm sure you got another one waiting in the wings for me here.
Well, sure. And I wanted to harken back to the This Week in Numismatic History. This is a, I would say, novice level question if it's on the Coin World Trivia game, but that's not from where I'm drawing this. But what makes that 1942 Philadelphia struck wartime nickel so special? You know, I mean, it's, we mentioned it earlier that it's silver, and you know, those wartime nickels all had the mint marks above Monticello, but there's something about that 1942 Jefferson nickel struck in Philadelphia in wartime silver that's was historic. So think about that. This is probably a beginner level question, but you know, we don't always have to throw something obscure at you, like, you know, Portsmouth, Ohio mural wall people. But anyway, think about that. It's not really related to the topic of the interview this week. So there's you know, no good way to transition, but I will say, you will learn a lot by listening to this interview with Taylor Leverage, the author of the new book, By Weight, Not By Coin, An Introduction to Chop Marked Coins. Here is that interview. The Coin World Podcast is delighted today to be joined by Taylor Leverage, author of By Weight, Not By Coin, An Introduction to Chop Marked Coins. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Hey, yeah, thank you for, I think you reached out, yeah, and telling us about this great new book. It's been out here just in the last few months. Exhaustively researched book, 269 pages, large format, that's like 8.5 by 11, full color images. It is really a neat work. Before we delve into that, I guess we should set the stage for somebody who's not familiar, though. What is a chop marked coin, and how does that differ from maybe if I've heard of a counter stamped or counter marked coin?
Yeah, so chop marked coins refer to a very specific subset of counter marks that were applied in China and Southeast Asia by Chinese merchants, money changers, bankers, and what are called shroffs, all of whom were part of just general commerce. There was massive amounts of international trade between China and the rest of the world beginning in the 16th century. And a lot of that, how people paid for it, was through hard silver, because there was much less interest in the trade goods from Europeans on the Chinese side than it was for Europeans attaining Chinese goods like porcelain or silks, things like that. So Europeans had to import massive amounts of silver from the New World, in particular the Spanish colonies, but anywhere they could get their hands on it to pay for these valuable trade goods. And when Chinese merchants started to get them, there came along counterfeits that were imitating them. And so in response, they started a system of their own countermarks, usually in the form of Chinese characters, called chop marks. And they're typically just stamped into the coin, not any guarantees from any government or anything like that. It's just a single individual testing the validity of the silver and saying it passes, it can circulate. And so as coins traveled through China, they often received several chop marks just in the course of normal circulation, just from being validated. And so now you can encounter these on dozens and dozens of different world types from anywhere from the late 16th, early 17th centuries up until the 1930s.
And how did you get into that area of interest? I mean, you'd have to first be exposed to it, and then obviously you've dove down the rabbit hole, because here you are, you know, talking about a book and you're an expert now. But talk about that transition and how long it took and what got you started.
Sure. So I was a coin collector since I was a kid, doing the folders, all the classic stuff. I started to get back into it seriously again in college, undergraduate, 21, 22. I was looking for a short set that I could complete relatively quickly. So I was attracted initially to U.S. trade dollars. And U.S. trade dollars happened to be frequently chop marked because they were designed to be sent to China. So I said, well, the chop marked ones are typically less expensive. It's only an 18 coin set if you count the 75 S over CC. So I said, it shouldn't be too hard to put together a chop marked date set of US trade dollars. And so that's where I really got started on chop marks. And then I actually ran into a brick wall because it's, though it's short, it's virtually impossible to complete. The 78 CC is rare by itself. And actually the 75P is almost non-existent with chop marks. So I was never able to actually complete that set. And as I went on, I couldn't find some of those rarer dates. I started dabbling in some of the more esoteric chop mark coins, like started in other US types like seeded half dollars. Then gradually I realized there were all these other world coins that often traded at a discount compared to non-chopped examples that were just not necessarily sitting in melt bins, but often just hanging out on eBay or details like that. And there were not too many people pursuing them. So I started expanding into just a general world type set with chop marks. And that's still what I'm working on today. I still got the US trade dollar set in the back of my mind, but it's sort of taken a back seat when there's so much more diversity out there.
And so I have to, before we get too far into this, ask you about the title of the book. I love it. The origin's pretty cool. It's not the main title is not what I expected it to be off the bat, based on the previous two works by other authors. So can you talk about the origin of that title, By Weight, Not By Coin, C-O-Y-N-E? And just as a sort of an aside, I love the story.
Sure, absolutely. So the title came to me just pretty much by happenstance. I was researching maps of China from the early European contact and just going down some of the rabbit holes of what was available. And I purchased a map from a early 17th century book. It's called Samuel Purchase's Pilgrims is the name of the book. And it's, for the time, very exhaustively researched reference on all sorts of global trade geography, just right at the start of the age of exploration. So I bought this very rudimentary map of China, but on the back of that map of China, since it was a page of a book, it was covered in text. And part of the text, just by happenstance, talked about silver that was being used in China. And as far as I can tell, it's the first textual reference in English of how silver was used in China, talking about how silver was used by its weight, not by the issued denomination, which would have been, you know, relatively esoteric and strange for some, for an English audience in 1625 when that book was published. And so once I read that, I figured it just encapsulated both the spirit of how chop marks came about and how they would have been interpreted at the time.
So Purchase was the contemporary Rick Steves, I guess, in giving travel information for folks back then. Now, a lot of people, you've already touched upon this. So, kind of stealing my thunder, but that's cool. A lot of people naturally assume chop mark coins are all Asian or Spanish colonial, which you've mentioned that, but you've tracked down the American coins that you reference, including those trade dollars, and you got a Morgan dollar on the cover of the book. So that's all cool. But what was the most interesting aspect of their usage that you learned in writing this book? I mean, we know about the trade dollars being made specifically for use there. What was something that you didn't know beforehand or think a lot of people would be surprised to know?
I think just the range of types is just really stunning when you sit down to actually consider it, because there is this assumption that there's only, you know, a couple dozen, and they mostly are limited to the trade types from the late 19th century. You got the U.S. trade dollar, the French Indochina piaster, Great Britain trade dollar, Japanese yen. Because you can find those relatively easily. They're always available on eBay. But if you go down into the literature, you'll see references to all these very obscure types, each of which have their own unique history and tie in to their own politics back home, each of those individual stories, there were several different ones that I wouldn't have expected them to come about, like finding early Guatemala pillar eight reals or something like that, or Great Britain counterstamps from the Bank of England that were struck for Napoleonic use. And then all of a sudden they end up in all the way across the world in Great Britain. It reveals a level of interconnectedness in just general economics that is people don't think about for the time. We think about globalized economics as a relatively recent invention, talking about, you know, moving factories overseas in the 80s or something like that. But no, this has been around for centuries, and that we've got really hard evidence of it right here in coins that's just been sort of glanced over because they're looked at just as damaged and used examples.
One of my favorites, actually, just even though, you know, somebody could say, well, how is it a favorite? You don't even have it imaged in there. But it's the Danish Asiatic company, the Greenland dollar, or piastre. It introduces a concept I want to sort of riff off of a little bit. The rarity rating is R1, and that means there's only one known. It sounds like there are examples that may still exist today that can be found with the right sort of scholarship and stewardship of the topic that can expand knowledge of the whole scene. There's still more to be discovered about this topic even now, I guess, is the point.
Yes, absolutely, very much so. I mean, before this book, there were really only two references in English on that, and that, you know, that covers, you know, 100 years of collecting and 400 years of commerce. So especially since there has not been very much done from Chinese researchers, they're not really as much of interest to Chinese numismatists at the moment. I think there's tons more information available in Chinese sources that people just haven't dived into yet. That piece you mentioned, the Greenland dollar, was only found in the past couple decades from a melt bucket in a Hong Kong dealer. So, I mean, that's a rare coin by itself. It's extremely rare and a very desirable trade coin, even without being shop marked. But the fact that there's still not only coins out there to be discovered, but plenty of period references that just haven't been made accessible to the people that are currently researching, I think we're going to see a lot more scholarship in the coming decades. It's really going to change our understanding of how silver was used in China.
You touch upon the rarity factor, and this sort of begs the question to go back to something you referenced a little while ago. When it comes to value, is there a hard and fast rule for chop mark coins versus quote unquote non-damaged examples? I mean, I know, yeah, some people have always viewed chop mark coins as damaged, but it seems like, and you've referenced this before, worth less money or available to be obtained for less than a unchopped piece. Are there exceptions where rarity makes that chop marked example much more desirable and more valuable, or is it, I guess, maybe the answer, it depends based on the type?
It's very much context dependent. So for all the common types, they're virtually always going to be less valuable unless you've got a really choice uncirculated example. But there's definitely a threshold after which a chop marked example surpasses the value of a clean one. So something, there might be a common type relative in absolute terms that's known in hundreds of thousands of examples, but just wasn't exported to China heavily, something like a Guatemala peso or a Guatemala counter stamp applied to some other South American crown. Those were applied, you know, in the number of millions, and they still exist in large quantities today. But if you find a chop marked one, then all of a sudden that passport that the coin represents is all of a sudden much more diverse. It's much more tangible, and it becomes much more valuable than an unchopped host. It's still going to be dependent on who's collecting and who's in the room on a given day for if it's an auction scenario, because though chop marks are very interesting, the high end of the collector market's relatively thin right now. You're talking, you know, a couple dozen serious players at most. So it depends on whether or not, you know, three guys instead of four has an example in their collection. If there's two guys that really want it and an example hasn't turned up in recent years, then they can go to bat for it. And all bets are off if it's something really unusual or unique like that Greenland dollar or something like a South American Republic issue like a volcano peso, which is, you know, suggested to exist, but we haven't seen one yet. If one of those came up, then all the major collections are missing it, then it would be much more valuable than a clean, unmarked example.
Oh, that really poses challenges then. I mean, you know, everyone wants to know what something is worth, and it might be difficult to determine that with some of these pieces. You touched upon this as already as well. It seems like for a long time, the market for chop mark coins was much stronger in the U.S. and elsewhere than China. And it seems like that's been the case and remains the case. How does one navigate these waters? I mean, are there people, you mentioned saving a coin from a melt bucket in Hong Kong. Is this increased demand in the West driving this stuff into the market? I mean, how should collectors engage with that, with the knowledge or the maybe concern about counterfeits, especially also coming from the East?
Yeah, it's going to be a problem that's going to go hand in hand. Like, as anything gets more popular, it's going to be people that try to take advantage of it. And chop marks are particularly susceptible to it, unlike something like counter stamps, because you don't have things like die indicators or any sort of established scholarship as to what constitutes a genuine chop mark. There are clearly fake chop marks, but there are also very convincing forgeries as well that have been discovered through happenstance. So a lot of what we try to do is we try to establish provenance on rare examples. And part of the motivation I had for the book was not only to publish examples that had been sold in auctions from decades ago, if possible, but also just to publish a large volume of chop marks so people could understand those stylistic cues that go into genuine examples. For coins coming out of China, Hong Kong today, really the best bet that you have is going through a trusted dealer. There's a couple that have made contact with the U.S. chop mark community that often search for chop marks among the older Hong Kong dealers, Chinese mainland dealers, just to see what's available. We still haven't seen much in the way of high-end chop marks on rare types, at least none that aren't immediately evident. Most of what you see right now is mass-produced fakes of relatively mid-range examples, especially U.S. trade dollars. Chop mark U.S. trade dollars, buying them raw, especially if it's tied to China, is very risky at the time being. But PCGS tends to be pretty good when it comes to identifying genuine hosts. And if the host is genuine, typically the chop marks are genuine as well, because the rule still holds in most cases that chops on a U.S. trade dollar still depreciate the value of the coin as a whole. So I would either find a trusted dealer if you're buying from China directly, or ideally someone who has coins from an older collection, auction provenance and previous plates. The book actually lists several older collections that were sold in the 80s and 90s that have documentation, including the Rose collection, the Hal Walls collection. Either those were published in books, or they have auction records from a catalog that make sure that they have a fair degree of age on them, and they can actually be verified beyond just an example that pops up fresh on the market.
And it's a darn shame the Rose collection is so tough to find those pieces today. And you know, the whereabouts are so hard to pin down. It seems like one of the things that can also certainly assist would-be collectors is the rarity rating that is assigned in the book. And that gets to my one little quibble, but it's not your fault, because the rarity rating to me is inverse to how many sources define rarity. Now, it makes sense to have an R1 piece be one known because one equals one. But if I'm coming at it from a Civil War token background, that takes some getting used to. I believe the R1 is most common in that sense. Now, I understand this comes from Colin's book, the most recent, and I want to say that was maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, 2014.
Colin Goldberg's book. But other than that, I am in love with this new book. It's you know, you've got hundreds of full color photos, lots of details. It is a fantastic work. I just throw that out as if I'm going to be critical, and I try to put myself in the seat of the listener and the collector, going, well, do I really need to get this? It's great. It's fantastic. And we'll talk more about where you can get it and all that in a bit. But that is the one tiniest little thing I go, it's going to take some getting used to.
Yep, you're not the first person to comment on that. I've received a couple of comments on that before, because it is inverted from the standard rarity rating index, essentially. It was a balance between either correcting to the larger standard or continuing the standard that had been used in chop marks already. And I opted for the latter.
And that makes total sense. And, you know, nobody can fault you for that. But speaking of Colin's book now, suppose someone has his book and or the Rose book, and I do have both. Can I get rid of these now and this replaces it? Or is what maybe value is there besides seeing just the development of the numismatic scholarship over time?
Well, I certainly wouldn't advocate ever getting rid of any books because books always have value. And getting those two books is honestly very tough right now because they had fixed print runs and they're very tough to find. I think they both still have plenty of value. They both have unique information. Colin's book in particular includes a lot of period references that I did not have access to. And Rose's book is the original. So even though a lot of the information is now outdated because he didn't have the internet when he was making his book and it was entirely based off of firsthand sources in his collection, just the access to the images alone is an invaluable resource because his is probably still the best collection that's ever been assembled. And as you mentioned, it's a shame that so few have been tracked considering he had thousands of coins. I would not say my book is a replacement for those. I just tried to get as much information from all the standard sources. Those two books, as well as the Chopmark News, which I highly recommend everyone subscribe to, the standard periodical in the series, and just making sure people had access to them when they were looking up individual types, because it used to be not only a trouble to track down those books and old back issues of the news, but then combing through them for specific information on individual types. Like say you had something unusual, it was became tough to determine whether or not it was unusual, at least on the fly. So that was really what I was going for with my book, even though there is a lot of original information that was not included in any previous reference. So absolutely don't get rid of those books. They still have very valuable information from their own sources, though you don't need them necessarily to get started. Part of that is why I included it as an introduction to Chopmark coins. It has everything you need to know if you wanted to get started on collecting, but there is definitely a rabbit hole to dive down into.
Well, you're a man after my own heart saying not to get rid of books, and that's great to hear. And now you mentioned that these earlier books are tough to get. The one thing you've managed to do is work around a limitation with earlier issues. And this book is, there's no limit to how many examples will exist out there other than how many folks order them. How can people find this book and tell us about all those good details?
Yep. So the book is available on Amazon right now. As you mentioned, some of those previous titles operated on fixed print runs, and they were a bit obscure to obtain even when they were available. And now those runs have long since dried up. So you're just left finding examples on the secondary market. This book is intended to be obtainable by anyone with an internet connection. So it's available on Amazon right now for direct purchase. It's print on demand. Just search the title by weight, not by coin. It should pop up right away.
And of course, C-O-Y-N-E in reference to coin. And now, so this just came out, I guess, in the last month or two. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but have you heard more information that can come in a later edition? And what are you thinking as far as you keep this out there for X number of months, years, whatever, or are you content to let it rest? Are you going to continuously update? What are your plans or thinking down that route?
So one of the good things about the Amazon publication is you can actually edit the contents with the book still being live. It's just future editions will be printed with small revisions. So I've already done a couple stealth updates with just changing some grammatical errors, details like that. But I already have a document I've been keeping of new information that I've found, just browsing old periodicals, details like that, and new coins that have become available. As I did not include every chop-marked crown that I could find. There's already been a Costa Rican crown, which isn't included, a Colombian crown as well. So there is plenty of material for me to go back and publish a future edition. But if I do so, I probably won't add anything major until a full second edition comes out. And that'll probably be, you know, at least a few years from now. I want to give enough time for a second edition to be warranted.
Totally understand that. You know, so minor things between now and then, and then eventually the record can be updated just with more meaning. So it sounds like if somebody wants to delve into this path, they need to jump in now or soon. In sales, you always have to make a call to action. You don't want to tell somebody, oh yeah, it'll be out there for 5 years. But get this, the sooner the better you can learn about this fascinating topic, area of the hobby. And there's so much fun to be had, so much to learn. And we thank you so much for A, publishing the book, getting it out there, and then certainly talking about it with us here today on the Coin World podcast.
No, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And that was our interview with Taylor Leverage, author of a new book about Chopmark coins. Again, got to get it. It's great. So many collectors I've seen reviews of it online. They love it. It's really not just somebody who's interested in Chopmark coins. It's not just for those folks. It's if you're into Spanish Colonial, there's all sorts of details about that and stories of that. It's really a neat work and has a pride of place in my numismatic library.
Indeed, it should, because that's very fascinating information. Again, I learned quite a few things just by listening to that interview. And of course, the book is on the hit list to make sure that I get that so I can learn more about that, because it's a great subject and which to learn more about. And certainly Taylor doing all the research in this, an exhaustive effort indeed, and one to be commended. And want to thank Taylor for his time to come on to the show and be a part of the Coin World podcast. We've got a few more guests that are starting to line up here. And I know we talked to a lot of folks in Pittsburgh, and we'll get them moving here so that we're going to have a busy, busy third quarter, fourth quarter here as we continue. But want to thank all of you, all of listeners who have helped make this Coin World podcast so successful over the period of time. You keep raising the bar on us here so that we have the opportunity to bring you more and more, because there's still a lot of untouched subjects out there that we really like to get our hands wrapped around here. If you're not already a subscriber, please do. If you have friends that are interested in, especially those young numismatists here, because they can really embrace the digital side of things. And we're certainly looking forward to learning from those. We're not just here to teach, we're here to learn as well. So it's been great, and I'm pretty much spoken up. I got to get in a nap after that trip to Pittsburgh.
I hear you too. So as always, I will close with the cheerful admonishment to happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.